Christians should operate fully in the public square, and that includes by engaging with the media.
Molly Hemingway talking about her joint presentation at the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And one of the things that they can do is encourage reporters to report things accurately and truthfully. They can express their opinions in letters to the editor and op-eds. And one of the things that's important is to just let people in the world know of the differences of opinion that are out there, that Christians don't share a lot of the secular thinking that is promulgated by the media. And so being bold and being able to stand up and simply speak truth in the public square, it's a powerful witness to others, and it's a service you can perform for your community and the country at large.
You can meet and hear Molly and Mark Hemingway making the case for Christians engaging the news media at our Fall Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston, Texas. Learn more at issuesetc.org. You stop and think about it. You could take one third of your New Testament. You could pull out that one third. That one third of the New Testament was written by one guy, inspired by the Holy Spirit, written by one person. Now, by his own accounting, he had a lot of help writing those two books. He did extensive research. He talked to the people who were there, and he put it together in this orderly account or this narrative. And he did it for both of his books, both for the Gospel of Luke and for the Acts of the Apostles. And the church is remembering evangelist, and really in some ways more than simply the penner of one of the Gospels, but also of the account of Peter and Paul and their preaching, Luke, on this day, and we're going to be remembering him as well. Welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Joining us to remember Luke the Evangelist, Dr. Arthur Just. He's professor of New Testament and chairman of the Department of Exegetical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, author of the two-volume Concordia Commentary on Luke and the book Heaven on Earth, The Gifts of Christ in the Divine Service. Dr. Just, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Wonderful to be with you today.
In your study of Luke's books, that would be the Gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles, you obviously then also study the man Luke, the evangelist Luke. What in all that study do you find most intriguing about Luke the evangelist?
I think it's the beauty of his writing and the depth of his theology and his commitment to evangelize the world with the Apostle Paul and his relationship to Paul. I think that when you look at Luke, you see somebody who has been given an incredible gift to use the language of the Roman Empire at the time, and to do it in such a literary way that appeals to an audience that he's trying to address, a Gentile audience, and that it's just pure pleasure to talk about him, to study him, to just dissect how he puts together the story of Jesus. It's just beautiful from beginning to end.
Do we have any idea how Luke himself enters the picture of the New Testament? I mean, we find him suddenly in the book of Acts using the first person plural pronoun, so here I am, so to speak. And then, of course, his gospel. But do we know where he enters the picture? Could he have been at least kind of a latecomer to Jesus' band of disciples? Could he have been, maybe as Paul might have been, an adversarial eyewitness of some of the things that occurred?
Could be. I mean, we really don't know very much. I think the most compelling evidence of his background is that he's a Greek. He's from Thebes in Greece. So he's a true Hellenist, and he comes from the place where I think he spent a lot of time as a pastor. I am totally convinced that when he joins Paul in Troas, when Paul gets the Macedonian call and goes over to Europe into Macedonia, and then is left behind by Paul, it appears, in Philippi for about 7 years until the third missionary journey when Paul circles back there 7 years later, that that time he was in Philippi as the pastor in that congregation, preaching and teaching and catechizing, and that he was suited for that because he was from Greece. I mean, even though Macedonia isn't necessarily Greece, it's very close, same peninsula. And I think that one of the reasons why the Philippian congregation is the one that is maybe the most beloved of Paul and the one that loves Paul the most is because it had a good pastor. And I'm completely convinced that Theophilus is a catechumen or a newly baptized person in the Philippian congregation, somebody who Luke or Paul or both had captured with the gospel by their preaching, and that he is somebody who had the capacity financially to underwrite the writing, not just of the gospel, but Acts. And that when Paul comes back through there and picks up Luke and goes back to Jerusalem and Luke is with him, that this is where they are figuring out how it is that Luke will write Paul's gospel, a gospel to the Gentiles. And I think that plan is finally hatched. This isn't my theory, but it's the theory of Bo Reiki. When he's imprisoned in Caesarea, Paul is from 58 to 60, and that it's there that Luke was in a sense with Paul, in consultation with Paul, was to go off and write Paul's gospel, so to speak. And I think that's maybe where, because Mark is there too, that Mark was commissioned to write Peter's gospel. So those two gospels would be written sometime after 58, after the missionary journeys of Paul are over and before he makes his way to Jerusalem.
So
Rome, sorry.
Let's talk about that, because Luke is quite clear at the beginning of his gospel that other people had undertaken to tell the story, to record it. He was going to do it in a way, what does he call it? He has a word, a phrase there that he uses
he
about
he calls it a narrative.
What
That's
does he
what
mean by
write.
That?
Well, I think it's the right word for him. I mean, Matthew calls it a biblos, which is essentially a Bible, scripture. And Mark's the one who coins the word gospel. But narrative is it's a leading out of the story. And I think Luke is appealing here to an Hellenistic audience that is very taken by narratives and literary narratives with beautiful structures. That's why I said the beauty of Luke. I mean, his literary structures, the way in which he uses all the possible literary ways of communicating a story like the story that he writes in the gospel, he uses every one of them. I mean, he's got chiasms and inclusios, and the principle of balance is very much, you know, deeply embedded in his work. The fact that he's continually weaving themes, this echoing back of themes. I mean, it's an endless sort of study of Luke to be able to discover all that he's up to. It's just an amazing piece of work. And I think that he is suggesting that this conforms to what, you know, Greeks at the time, Gentiles at the time would expect of something of this caliber. And I mean, just the incredible capacity he has to write this extraordinary Greek in the first four verses. I mean, strutting his stuff. And then in the fifth verse, when he starts telling the story of Zechariah in the temple, he launches into what we would call a Septuagintal Greek, the Greek that was used to translate the Old Testament. And it sounds like the Old Testament. It sounds like the Bible. And it's inhabited with people who, you know, seem to come right out of the Old Testament, Simeon and Anna, of course, Zechariah, Elizabeth, John, and Jesus, Mary and Joseph. I mean, it's got songs that sound like Old Testament canticles. It sounds like it. It's just an amazing piece of work to be able to do that. It would have sounded archaic, but they would have understood what he was doing because, you know, obviously many of these Gentiles are God-fearers. They've heard the Old Testament, and Luke sounds like the Old Testament. It's just, it's an extraordinary move. And then, of course, in chapter 3, he he returns to kind of a contemporary Koine Greek, not of the caliber of his first four verses, but certainly of a high level of the Greek that everybody would have understood at that time.
And that is a, if his audience is in fact these Hellenists or these Greeks who are God-fearers, who are familiar with the narrative of the Old Testament, to deliver something to them in kind of respectable tones like this said a lot, didn't it?
It did. I mean, there's a kind of a whole school of Lucan scholarship that describes his gospel as an apologetic, a defense of the faith. And I think there's some truth to that. I do feel that he is, for a Gentile audience, defending the faith. But I make a very nuanced distinction here, and that is that it's written for Gentiles, but it's not written to them, at least not in the context in which Luke was writing. And what I mean by that is it was written for Jewish Christians who were evangelizing Gentiles, because it is intentionally filled with all kinds of Jewish stuff that is not in Matthew. You know, I mean, he has more on the temple, more on the Passover, more on the laws, the purity laws, the Sabbath laws, the table fellowship laws. He has more on just basic Jewish stuff. I mean, he begins in the temple, ends in the temple, does that in the infancy narrative. I mean, he starts in the holy place, one step away from the Holy of Holies. I mean, Gentiles wouldn't have known this. So he has to explain it all. And so he gives the framework for a catechesis of them that Jewish Christians would use in catechizing, you know, Gentiles who really didn't know anything about the Old Testament. Now, there are the God-fearers who would. Yeah, I mean, that's part of the audience. But I think that he has a larger plan in mind. This is why I started by saying, I mean, his commitment to evangelizing the world with Paul. I mean, they're going after the whole enchilada. They're going after all the Gentiles. They're not just limiting themselves to those who have happened to hang out in synagogues and have been already struck by the Old Testament. They're going after people who had never ever heard of anything Jewish before, and they're giving Luke's giving the framework in his gospel so that they can understand the person of Jesus in all his Judaic background, how he worshiped, how he thought, how he fought with the Pharisees, what were the issues, why were they issues. I mean, it's an amazing thing to have a Gentile gospel so filled with such Jewishness.
Dr. Arthur Just is our guest. We'll talk more about that on the other side of the break. To what degree then does Paul, who's a Hebrew of Hebrews and a former Pharisee, serve as a resource to Luke? Remembering Luke the Evangelist with Dr. Arthur Just, I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Mount Zion Lutheran Church in Greenfield, Wisconsin, is a congregation of those gathered by the Spirit of the Lord around His saving word and sacraments. At the center of our life together is the divine service of the risen Jesus, the Lamb of God who was slain, who takes away the sin of the world. If you are in the Milwaukee area, we invite you to share with us in our Lord's gifts of forgiveness and new life. Services are on Saturdays at 5 p.m. and Sundays at 9 a.m. For more information, visit our website at mountziongreenfield.org.
Ever attended an Issues Etc. conference or any number of events that take place across the Synod and wondered why more people from your congregation aren't there? Then check out the special seminar package the CLCC is offering for the 500th anniversary. All you need so your circuit can prepare, promote, and present a seminar that will appeal to all the members of your congregation, provided for free by the CLCC. Just go to theclcc.org. theclcc.org and click on the blue box or check us out on Facebook.
Your daily Lutheran Bible class. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the language of medicine and law today. Visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. You can promote your confessional Lutheran church and support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining our congregational sponsorship program, the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. You'll find an informational flyer on the support page at issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline, the Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Arthur Jess is our guest, remembering Luke the Evangelist. Church remembers him on the 18th of October. Before the break, you were talking about all the Jewish material that is found there, Hebrew material that's found in Luke's gospel in order to be a gospel to the Gentiles. In that vein, to what degree do you think Paul, who says, I'm Hebrew of Hebrews, he's a former Pharisee, to what degree do you think he acts as a source for what Luke writes?
Oh, I think he is. I mean, I think that these guys, you know, not only traveled together, but knew each other in some way that was deep and abiding. I think that Luke must have had some way of getting to Israel at some point, to Palestine, to see the places that he writes about. And maybe it was only in that final missionary journey. But you have to think that his knowledge of the Old Testament, his capacity to record what he does and weave it in such a way that it's not just proof texting, but it's more subtle than that. He's not just simply citing the Old Testament, which he does, but he reflects patterns, types. I mean, he has echoes that only a sophisticated person with a sophisticated knowledge, I should say, of the Old Testament would be able to do. But I think he and Paul talked about this at length. And one of the things that I think that is important is that I'm guessing from the way in which you see Luke, especially in Acts, sort of trotting out the life of Paul, is that he was like a Barnabas to Paul. I mean, Luke and Barnabas were probably the same sort of people. Paul was probably a little rough around the edges, kind of a headstrong bull in the china shop kind of guy. And Luke makes Paul appear to be somebody who can be seen for what he really was. And that was this extraordinarily charismatic, impassioned preacher of the good news, who, even though, you know, he might have broken a few eggs, the march of the gospel could only have happened with somebody like that, who had that Pharisaical background, who had that rabbinic training, but also had that Gentile background, who grew up in Tarsus in a very sophisticated Roman city, who probably had, you know, an education up till, you know, the time of puberty of a wealthy Hellenistic person, knew his rhetoric, you know, just extraordinary education. And I think what Luke does is he makes it possible for people who would have been opposed to Paul, especially out of the Jerusalem church, to see the genius of Paul, and then to open up for everybody the extraordinary reality that in 12 years or less, Paul evangelized the whole world. You know, I always tell students, think about what you were doing 12 years ago. And in those 12 years, Paul, you know, when he had 12 years, he basically took the gospel to the entire world.
A lot is made of the parallel and similarities between Luke's gospel and Matthew and Mark. And I think kind of the standard idea is that we're dealing with what the, you know, old theologians would have called a kerygma, that is a kind of a pattern of preaching that forms the basic kind of framework for how you tell the story of Jesus. But what I'm struck about is how different they are as well. And Luke's gospel really shows this forth. Luke has stuff that, you mentioned him going traveling to Judea. He has stuff that only comes from stuff people like Mary and others, or those who are very, very close. Yeah. To these principal characters.
No, I agree. I mean, I think that's what his prologue says. He did his research. He talked from eyewitnesses. And I think he was given access to people who were able to give him the absolute inside story on things that only they would have known, like Mary, like the Emmaus disciples. I mean, even some of the parables that he had to come to him in such a way that they were from somebody who was an eyewitness and heard them and was able to give them to him in a form that he could show the genius of Jesus' teaching in those regards. Yeah, no, I mean, there are such parallels, but at the same time, there are such differences. And I'm totally convinced that the differences are missional in the sense that each gospel was written in order to, you know, bring about a conversion of a particular people. I think Matthew was early because it was the gospel for the Jewish mission. I think Luke and Mark are the gospels for the Gentile mission. And you can see how they are targeted for a particular kind of person. And certainly a Jew could love and benefit from Mark and Luke and a Gentile from Matthew. But you can see that there is a shift that takes place, and that when Luke, you know, writes, we have moved now, as Paul says in Acts, you know, we have moved beyond the Jewish mission. We are now the Gentiles are listening. Let's move in that direction. Not that they shake the dust off their feet against the Jewish mission. They're still going to go to the Jews, but clearly the Gentile mission is where their focus is going to be, and now Luke's gospel is going to take it into that world.
A lot is also sometimes made of an offhand comment that Paul makes about Luke the physician, and I'm wondering what we should make of that. What does it mean, and why is it significant?
Well, there's been studies on this, and I remember early on in my studies of Luke, there were so many people who said, you know, there's just no more, medical terminology in Luke and Acts than anywhere else. But one of the things you'll see, though, is that Luke has more healings. And he, you can see this in the tradition of the church, in the collect even for St. Luke, that he is a gospel that's about healing. It's about bringing healing to the nations. And I am completely convinced, it's the way I teach Luke, that, and I think it's the primary way, you know, Jesus teaches the gospel, maybe with the exception of speaking about the kingdom of God, but that the language of the new creation, that we have a creation that is broken, that it's in bondage to sin and sickness and demons and death, and that Jesus comes to free that creation and heal it and to make all things new. And I think there you can see Luke the physician understanding that people can really respond to the notion of healing because it is so real, it's so concrete, it's so physical, it's so fleshly. And I mean, it was a broken world at the time of Jesus, and people were outcasts because of their illnesses, and Jesus restores them to that, to life, you know, out of the brokenness of their culture, their society, and then of course even their own bodies, and Luke the physician is, I think, deeply, deeply attuned to that notion of healing, that in Jesus you see the cure of souls and bodies, you know. I used to, as you know, run a deaconess program, and one of the lectures I always had out of Luke was he's got more, you know, concern for women than any of the other gospels, and I always had a lecture on how women are given in Luke to take care of the body of Jesus, you know, and there's even a sense of sort of, you know, taking care of the creator of the universe, you know, where he allows people to do that, especially women, you know, and you just think of the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes. That's a wonderful example of Luke's incredible literary design, that the sign of the incarnation is you'll find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes. The sign of the atonement is the body of Jesus, that same body wrapped in cloth bands, And then the sign of the resurrection is when Peter runs to the tomb in Luke 24:12, and he sees only the cloth bands. You know, those cloth bands, you know, expand the gospel and teach the incarnation, the atonement, and the resurrection. But who put those cloth bands on Jesus? It was Mary, and it was the women who came to anoint his body and wrap it. They were taking care of that body of Jesus. Follow the body. And the body is everything. And that body, when it touches other bodies, it frees them. It heals them. There's the physician. There's Luke understanding that body and soul together matter.
Dr. Arthur Just is our guest, remembering Luke the Evangelist. He is author of the 2-volume Concordia Commentary on Luke and the book Heaven on Earth, The Gifts of Christ and the Divine Service. Those medical terms as extolling Christ after the break.
Do you find yourself fixing the theology on store-bought greeting cards when you give them to friends and family? Put away that Sharpie. Edgruesome.com has greeting cards, art, jewelry, certificates, church banners, housewares, and all sorts of fantastic gifts that proclaim Christ crucified for us. Whether you're a value shopper or a collector, you'll find something at Edgruesome.com. That's Edgruesome.com.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
If you plan to buy one item commemorating the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, I highly recommend the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October. It's titled The Reformation. You'll want to display this richly illustrated book on your coffee table, in your church library, or anywhere you can easily flip through this informative and beautiful book. The Reformation is written by regular guest Dr. Cameron McKenzie. Learn more about The Reformation at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Old theology, new technology. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things: the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us: broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Remembering Luke the Evangelist. Dr. Arthur Just of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, is our guest. Dr. Just, before the break, you were talking about that concern of body and soul that's expressed, and Luke in part uses those physician's terms to do it. It sounds like what you're saying here is this isn't Luke simply saying, hey, I'm a physician, or kind of drawing attention to himself, but to simply extolling Christ.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And for developing a theology that is real and that every human being can relate to. This isn't abstract. This isn't a kind of a disembodied theology. This is real. Jesus comes, he touches people, and they're better. When his flesh enters the creation, the creation's never going to be the same again. And it gets personal. He actually goes into people's real lives and changes them. And I mean, it's a foretaste of what he ultimately does on the cross. I mean, I think the new creation comes to its reality in the cross. And there, you know, the release of all the bondage of the infection that sin brought into the world through the disobedience of our first parents is completely released. And you can see that at the crucifixion, the world, you know, I always say rocks and rolls. I mean, it doesn't know what to do because it's being recreated. There are earthquakes. There's temples, curtains being torn asunder. There's, of course, the greatest sign of all, the darkness. You know, in Matthew, the dead rise and 3 days later walk around the city. I mean, the creation itself is affected at the moment of the crucifixion. And you see little glimpses of that, this little personal care that Luke records. I mean, the other Gospels do too, but Luke does it in such a way that it is sort of foundational and fundamental to the whole way in which he lays out the narrative of Jesus' life.
You had mentioned the temple, a story that begins as far into the temple as you can go without being the high priest on the Day of Atonement. And does he... We say it in radio, donut principle, it comes back around. Does he bring that back around at the end of his gospel?
Yeah, he does. I mean, he has the disciples returning to the temple with great joy in order to worship God. And it's an astounding moment after the ascension that they and it's with joy. Joy is one of the great themes of Luke. I mean, the joy of chapter 15 and the lost sheep and the lost coin and the lost son, joy at the feast, the table fellowship. That was what my thesis was on in Emmaus. I mean, the joy that comes from feasting the of the lost that is now found, and the disciples not quite knowing what they're doing. You know, I mean, there's still a little bit of a mystery to them as to how this is all going to play out. But even after their Lord has left them, they go back to the place of presence, even though, in a sense, it's no longer, you know, a significant place, because the place is going to be wherever Jesus' body is. And there's our good Lutheran theology of real bodily presence in word and sacrament. I mean, there's the new temple. There's the new Zion. There's the city of God. There is where God is going to be found. James certainly understood that in Acts 15, in his sermon, whatever you want to call it, from Amos. You know, that this new temple is coming, and it's the body of Jesus, and Gentiles, everyone is invited to be part of that. And entrance into that is, again, a great Lucan theme. It's through repentance. It's through forgiveness of sins. That's John's preaching. It's Jesus' preaching. It's the final instructions that Jesus gives his disciples in Luke 24, right before he ascends. So one of the themes that I always accent in Luke is the shift in the locale of God's presence. And he's got to talk about the temple, because that's where God was. You know, this is the Father's house. This is where he must be about the Father's business. But that business now is transacted in the body of Jesus, and he is now the new temple. And in the healing of the 10 lepers, you know, the 9 Jews, you know, they did the right thing. They were going back to the temple to verify this. But the Samaritan got it. He said, no, the temple is shifted to the body of Jesus. So I'm not going to go to the temple. I'm going to go back to Jesus, because he's the one who we now see as the presence of God and the place of holiness.
When St. Paul is writing to the Corinthians and he takes up the subject of the Lord's Supper and their abuse of it, he has this place from which we generally draw, with a little tweaking, the words of institution in the rite. And it's remarkably close to the very words we find Jesus speaking there in the Gospel of Luke. Obviously, there's a connection between the two men in terms there. But I think 1 Corinthians comes quite a bit before that. That are we getting a little preview of Luke there when Paul says, I deliver to you that which the Lord handed down to me? And he speaks those words of institution.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I would say that if you compare, they're the two traditions, the Matthean and Markan tradition, which many scholars call the cultic tradition. I don't know if that's necessarily true or not, but I mean that it's more of a liturgical tradition, and that Luke and Paul have the testamentary tradition, namely that what the Lord's Supper is in Luke, and that Paul would affirm this, or that Luke affirms Paul, is that this is the last will and testament of Jesus. And Luke's institution narrative is put in the framework of a farewell discourse, you know, like the parting of a person who is about to die or is, you know, kind of willing over his estate. You see Jesus doing that to his disciples. And the magnificent, again, literary character of Luke's institution narrative is extraordinary. He's the only one who, in connection with the bread and the cup, has the language of substitution on behalf of you, that which is given on behalf of you, that which is poured out on behalf of you. And Luke has the remembrance in connection with the bread. Paul has it with both, but Luke keeps it with just the bread. And you know, I think in some ways that highlights that is the most important part in some ways, you know, that this is where you remember his body broken in death. And I think that remembrance is what Paul, in a sense, is trying to say when he says, as often as you eat this body and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. That's what you remember. That's what you remember, his body broken in death. So yeah, the relationship between Paul and Luke in the institution narratives is extraordinary. And I think Luke reflects Paul, but he does add to it to complement his own narrative. And I mean, that's something I could go on and on about because that's something I love to talk about, but I don't think we have enough time for that, unfortunately.
Well, I'll let you hit one end of it. And you had mentioned the way Luke concludes his gospel. He has, if you just read it straight through, and it's really stunning if you haven't done it before, you just read it straight through, it's almost as though Jesus rises. Next thing you know, we've got this Emmaus interlude, which is right there in the same time, and then Jesus is gone. He vanishes from their sight, and then the next thing he's doing is ascending into heaven. How do you talk about that kind of unique feature of the very important ending of Luke's gospel?
Well, you know, Luke is the gospel of many things, and one is, it is the gospel of the resurrection. He has an extraordinary theology of the resurrection. The old higher critics used to say that Luke, you know, in a sense, has this theology because he's covering up for the embarrassment of the cross, and that he has no atonement theology, and that, you know, he's sanitizing the hardness of Matthew and Mark by providing us with this extraordinary glimpse of the resurrection of Jesus. But I think what really is happening in Luke 24 is that you see how at the very end here, in fact, I mean, this was my PhD thesis, how, and it was on Emmaus, how Emmaus and the rest of Luke 24 brings all the themes to a close. You can almost start in Luke 24, read it, and then go back and see how it all comes to a climax in Luke 24. And it's what I would call the hermeneutic of remembrance. And it is, you know, remember as I spoke to you while I was in Galilee, the angels say to the women. We're supposed to go back and see that. It's Luke 9. And Luke 9 is an extraordinary chapter. In fact, there's a chiasm between Luke 9 and Luke 24, intentional by Luke to tie those two together. And then, you know, Jesus says in his final words to the disciples, remember as I spoke while I was still with you, as I spoke to you. And then he gives out this incredible kerygma of his passion and resurrection on the basis of the scriptures. But one of the things that is really interesting is in Luke 24, Luke is just incredibly careful about time references. There are five of them in Emmaus. He wants us to know that this is taking place on the first day of the week, the third day of the 3 days, and what I would call the eighth day, the first day of the new creation. And yet, when he finishes Emmaus, you know, and he says at that hour they go back, he stops having any time references. I don't know if this is what you're referring to, Todd, but I'm going to pick up on it. So right away, he, you know, it looks like he goes into a house that same day. It says peace to this house, you know, which is a whole Lucan theme. That's the greeting of the kingdom now. That's the mission. You go to the, you go from house to house with peace and you bring word and meal. And then immediately, you know, he gives his final instruction and immediately there's the ascension. There are no time references there. And I think what Luke is suggesting, you know, what higher critics would say is that poor Luke, he was confused. He didn't know that these didn't all happen on Easter Sunday. And when he wrote Acts, he kind of corrected himself by saying the ascension was on the 40th day. But that's not, I don't think that's in any way close to understanding what Luke's doing. When bread is broken and eyes are opened in the Emmaus meal, and they see for the first time a human being in Luke, the crucified and risen Christ, we have entered the eschaton. There is no reason now to make any time references. So yeah, for Luke, we're all in the end time. So there, he purposely, after being so incredibly precise about time references, he purposely leaves them out so that we have this sense now of living in the end times, which is exactly what the Eucharist does, is it puts us in touch with the angels and the archangels and the whole company of heaven. You know, Todd, that's one of my favorite themes.
Dr. Arthur Just is our guest, professor of New Testament and chairman of the Department of Exegetical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, author of the 2-volume Concordia Commentary on Luke and the book Heaven on Earth, The Gifts of Christ in the Divine Service, Remembering Luke the Evangelist. Folks, we are approaching the 300 mark for attendees of the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. Attendance is limited to 400. Speakers there include Mark and Molly Hemingway, Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morris, Rod Dreher, and Dr. Scott Murray. You can register by calling 618-223-8385 or at issuesetc.org. The 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston, Texas. When we come back, we'll talk about one unique feature of Luke's crucifixion account, the thief on the cross.
Our cities are some of the greatest mission fields on the planet, but the footprint of the church is shrinking. We dare not shrink from our cities. Christ is needed now in our urban areas. From chaos, turmoil, decay, death, and destruction, Jesus brings peace, hope, resurrection, eternal life, and rebuilding. And you can help by being a hero for the city. Find out how at lcms.org/citymission or on Facebook at LCMS City Mission. Every city needs a hero. Capes and helmets not required.
What do Martin Luther's 95 Theses say and mean? What's the story behind Luther's famous hymn, A Mighty Fortress? How and why are Lutherans celebrating the 500th anniversary of the Reformation this month? Find answers to these questions and more in the October issue of The Lutheran Witness. Visit cph.org/trylutheranwitness to get 6 issues of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's flagship magazine for only $6.99. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Expert guests, expansive topics, extolling Christ. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Children are entitled to a relationship with both of their parents, and they're entitled to know who they are.
Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morris of the Ruth Institute talking about her presentation at the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And if you take that entitlement as basic and reason backwards from that, what you'll end up with is the whole traditional Christian sexual morality. Get married, stay married, and only have sex with the person you're married to.
You can meet and hear Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse making the case against the sexual revolution at the Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. Registration is $120 and includes 3 meals. Child care is free. For more information, look for the Making the Case logo at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston. We are remembering Luke the Evangelist. Dr. Arthur Just is our guest. Dr. Just, I'd like you to speak a little bit about one of the unique features of Luke's crucifixion account. And first of all, you have Jesus through the whole account absolving people. Boy, he's absolving the people who are actually crucifying him. Father, forgive them. And then we come to the thief on the cross, this man who on the last day of his life, being punished for his crimes, ends up next to Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons why maybe I love Luke is that I think it's such a Lutheran gospel, because I think Luke preaches the gospel through the forgiveness of sins. And I think the new creation, the release, which is the word that we use for forgiveness, that word in Greek is the word that's for forgiveness. That's the great Lucan theme. And so on the cross, forgiveness is the theme. And at 9 a.m. when he's crucified, I think that's when he speaks his first words, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And then just before the darkness comes, he ends with another absolution. And I think the thief on the cross, when he hears the words, "Today you will be with me in paradise," that's like the ultimate absolution. So he begins with an absolution and he ends with an absolution. The only other words that he speaks is, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit," which would have been, you know, right before he died at 3 in the afternoon. So he, in the three great hours, 9 a.m., noon, and 3, are the times when Luke records the words of Jesus. And before the darkness comes, and I think, you know, when the world is plunged into darkness, you know, you don't hear Jesus probably speaking very much there, at least not in Luke. And you can see, though, that until that darkness comes, Luke wants to suggest that you know, Jesus is, in his death, absolving the whole world. And again, it's typical Luke. He starts with the whole world, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And then it's always personal. It's always down to one individual. And it's this thief on the cross and the drama of that. You know, "Today you will be with me in paradise." And that frames his first words, his first, you know, public words in Nazareth, where he says, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your ears." You know, again, a great Lucan literary theme. It's incredible. He's amazing. It's just beautiful. It's just beautiful.
How would you say Luke describes the ministry of Jesus? You talked about more healings. But how would you, in general terms, describe the ministry of Jesus depicted by Luke?
Well, that's one of my favorite themes, too. I call it the prophetic pattern that Jesus fits, and you see this in Luke 4, and it's all the way through the Gospels, that Jesus is the culmination of the prophetic pattern of the Old Testament. And that pattern had two stages to it. The first stage is that a prophet is a preacher, first and foremost, a teacher, speaks for God, and secondly, testifies to that through miracles. Now, I define miracles this way, that miracles testify to the presence of God in his creation, making all things new. And that's what miracles do for Jesus. They say, okay, not only is he the Messiah, which they do, but he's here. And his fleshly presence is actually healing people and casting out demons, forgiving sins, and raising the dead. That first phase, teaching and miracles, I think conform to the liturgy of word and sacrament. And I think the apostles are, if you look at Luke 9, you look at the sending of the 70 in Luke 10, what are they sent out to do? To preach and to heal. Same things. I mean, it's almost, Luke beats you over the head with that. The second phase is that if you're faithful doing that, if you're a faithful preacher and you testify through your miracles, you're going to be rejected. You're going to be rejected. And all the prophets before him were, some to the point of death. Certainly John the Baptist was, and Jesus had the ultimate death. And the apostles do too. And, you know, there it is. He sends out the 9 and he says, you know, there are going to be places that reject you. You know, sends out the 12 in Luke 9, sorry. "And shake the dust off your feet as a witness against them." Then the 70, the same. So, I mean, there you can see the ministry is embedded in that prophetic pattern. And I always teach that what we are doing now in our pastoral ministry is simply continuing the teaching and miracle working of Jesus in word and sacrament ministry. And those who are faithful to that will suffer the rejection of the world and even in the church for being faithful to that very simple but very profound and deep understanding of what it means to make Christ present through word and sacrament.
You had mentioned earlier that Luke begins with all kinds of canticles that are reminiscent of the Old Testament. Talk about the role of worship in Luke's account of Jesus.
Well, his gospel, again, higher critics said, oh, it's early Catholicism, you know, the delay of the parousia, so we all have to hunker down and create church. So we're going to create worship forms, we're going to create ecclesiastical forms, we're going to create the ministry, blah, blah, blah. But what Luke understands is that it's all about presence. And, I mean, what Jesus did was devote himself faithfully to the places where God was present. He went to the temple and he preached in synagogues. God was present in the temple and God is present wherever his word is. And he handed down to his 12 and his 70 and then to the church beyond that presence now is going to be located in a gathering around word and a gathering around a table. And those are the classic elements of table fellowship. Table fellowship in the ancient world was that you had a gathering of people who had something in common to be taught by somebody and then to consummate that in the intimacy of a meal. So they had before dinner speakers. And the distinction, of course, with Jesus is that he is present there, and his presence may take on different forms during his Galilean ministry. It's different than at the Last Supper, and it's different than at Emmaus, and it's different than after Pentecost, but he's still present. And his presence there in word and meal, I mean, that is what the Emmaus story is all about. That's the last line in the Emmaus story is that, you know, they talked about the teaching on the road, there's the word, and as he was made known to them in the breaking of the bread, there's the sacrament. And Acts 2:42 carries that out. So, I mean, Luke is handing down and teaching, this is the way we are to worship, the structures of the liturgy that we are so, you know, such a part of our nature is word and sacrament. Luke goes out of his way to show how these are the foundations for the gathering of the people of God around the presence of Christ.
Luke is mentioned, I think, by name in Colossians, in one of the letters to Timothy, and of all places in Philemon, I think, as well. But he's all over the latter part of the book of Acts, at least in terms of his narration. What more do we know about Luke in his connection to the Pauline ministry?
Well, I think I started by talking a little bit about that. But he clearly is one of the intimates of Paul. And I would, as I did before, I would put him in the same category of Barnabas. He is the Barnabas of the second part of Paul's missionary journeys, in the second and then the third. And so I think he's somebody whose whole life was to essentially show the world the greatness of Paul by means of a gospel that reflects Pauline themes. And then the book of Acts, which of course the first part is about Peter, chapters 1 to 12, but then the second part is about Paul. And Paul in many ways parallels his Lord in the way in which he journeys to a place, Rome. You know, he suffers in the shipwreck. I mean, there's some real, you know, kind of Jesus parallels there, and you can see them in Peter too. But I mean, that is that Paul talks about that, how the sufferings of Jesus are kind of ongoing in the life of the church and even brought to a fulfillment in the suffering of the apostles. And I think Luke got that. I mean, I think he saw the sufferings of Paul. He himself probably suffered along with Paul. And you just read about the conversion of Paul, how much he must suffer on behalf of my name. Luke understood that. And Luke is, it's another theme. He has a whole theology of suffering. And it's shot through Luke and Acts, which, as we all know, is a third of the New Testament. So think about that. You know, and then you take the 13 letters of Paul, and between Luke and Paul, you've got maybe almost two-thirds of the New Testament.
What is your favorite passage from Luke's gospel and why?
While he was far off from the prodigal son, by far.
Why is that?
Because it shows the love and compassion of the father standing there at his house waiting for the prodigal son. That's the gospel. He's got father's always waiting for us. And he doesn't care how we come back, doesn't care what our motives are, but he's out there every day waiting. And then he runs, throws his arms around him. But that one line, while he was far off, it undoes me. I can hardly talk about it. There's a great novel, by the way, by Tobias Wolff, Old School, that also believes that those are the greatest words in the Gospel of Luke.
Dr. Arthur Just is professor of New Testament and chairman of the Department of Exegetical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of the 2-volume Concordia Commentary on Luke and the book Heaven on Earth, The Gifts of Christ and the Divine Service. You can purchase these resources by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 or browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Just, a blessed Luke the Evangelist Day to you.
Thank you for the privilege of talking about him today.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll discuss the Calvinist Reformation with Dr. Cameron McKenzie, author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, The Reformation. And those are poignant words, not just poignant, but actually to the very heart of what it is Luke is communicating through his gospel and through the Acts of the Apostles, that there is a waiting Father whose grace is not simply waiting, but proactive, going out and finding sinners, finding us where we are, and extending to us free gift of forgiveness in Jesus Christ alone. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
The Law Assumed Sermon, the Gospel Afterthought Sermon, the God Loves You Anyway Sermon. I've written an article in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled An Updated Listener's Guide to the Pulpit. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Matt Richard details his journey from folk Lutheranism to confessional Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal.